Welcome to VI Talk, sharing ideas, information and support.
Hi everyone, it's Jo and Dawn is with me. Hi Dawn.
Hello. Hi.
And it's a pleasure to welcome Richard Hawley, who plays the character Johnny Connor in Coronation Street. Hi Richard.
Hello, good evening.
Hi Richard.
Welcome. Hi, both. Thank you for joining us today.
No, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, pleasure. So you're going to fire some questions at me?
Yes, we will, if that's okay.
Yeah, now, it's great.
You know you play Johnny in Coronation Street. Can you just give us a brief description of what other roles you have played?
I suppose I've been an actor for 40 years. I started off very much within theatre in a kind of experimental company. And in the last few decades, I've kind of mainly done TV, partly because it's a living for me. And so I was lucky enough in the 90s to do a lot of the Prime Suspect series. You know, I was kind of with Helen Mirren. I was with one of her cops in about six of them or something like that in the first set of Prime Suspect. And that really was quite a launch pad into other things. I then did a series of my own called The Vet in the 90s. And then just kind of guest parts here and there. I did Love Actually. That's a famous one. I've done The Bill 4 times. I've had various operations on Casualty and Holby City. And I'm a jobbing actor. Really, you know, and then I joined Coronation Street about 5 years ago. I've been up, I have to say, over the last 20 years, I've probably been up for about 6 auditions. So, you know, kind of kept trying. It is something I wanted to do. It's a great show to be on. It's also a great, it's stable for an actor because it's very feast and famine is our world, you know. So I was grateful to get it for that level, but it gets very normal. You feel quite normal when you're there, but every so often, particularly in, you know, before all this, when we occasionally would show someone around the set, and I realized just what an extraordinary experience it is and I'm having and how privileged I am actually. So yeah, that's me.
Fabulous.
Yeah, in a nutshell.
So you've been in Corrie for 5 years or so. So your character, Johnny, was diagnosed with MS and as a consequence of that, a visual impairment. And the main reason really, I guess, that we're talking to you is about, although it's lovely to speak to you anyway, but it's about Charles Bonnet syndrome.
Yeah.
So how did you feel when you found out your character was going to have this diagnosis?
Well, I felt glad, really, because, I mean, first of all, the MS was a story a few years ago. It was a story in itself, and it was a supporting story, really, to other, you know, it was a kind of make or break in the marriage and, you know, what was going to happen when I was about to get married, and then they got this diagnosis. And, you know, I could see why they used it. It was a few years ago. It was a different producer. And it was done, you know, I certainly did it with the MS Society. And I'm still in touch with a guy who has MS, Richard, up there. And we still meet up and talk. And if I ever got an MS question, I ring him up direct. And I work still with the MS Society. But I'd actually done another soap years ago called Family Affairs. And they gave my character MS in that. And I was a bit concerned because I knew from that experience that it's a perfect illness, relapsing, remitting for drama, for a long-running drama. It means that, you know, if they need a little bit of attention, I can have a wobble. But then they don't always have the responsibility. They're not always responsible enough to kind of follow it up honestly, you know, and go, well, actually, what are the nuts and bolts going on more within this illness. And so when they came along with this Charles-Bonnet syndrome, I mean, it was also an attempt to revisit the MS, because not just, there's lots of characters on the soap who've all got terrible illnesses, but we're all walking around healthily. We have to, you know. But so to revisit it, and to revisit it in a way which is a much more substantial way, I mean, I know it's not a story about MS, but that's the trigger through the optic neuritis. It's a story then about Charles-Bonnet syndrome and sight loss, you know. So, but I was glad, really, that they were sort of revisiting it and putting a substantial kind of storyline into it. And then, of course, it's just the simple fact of raising awareness, which was, you know, I didn't realize at first how few people knew about this. And I hadn't realized how important it perhaps was to get this publicity for it, so that people can be educated about it and know what they've got, and not be quite as frightened as if you don't know what you've got. It's that simple.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was really happy to do it.
Mm-hmm. Did you know anybody?
I'll give the next answer a shorter.
Did you know anybody who was blind or partially sighted prior to you doing the research or anything like that?
I know anybody?
Yeah.
Do you know what? Not really. And I find that quite strange. My wife's granddad, who, you know, who passed a long time ago, but he was blind. So I knew him, and in a way, it's quite a strong effect that someone has on you, because, and I discovered elements of this through pretending to be blind and playing around with it, is you have to develop other senses. And, you know, you kind of, I don't know, you're listening directionally a lot more and stuff like that. And just the look of someone who's blind, you see their, there's a different set of senses. It's almost magical to see someone. It is. It's quite strange, I think. There's almost something very magical and lovely, because I know they can't see, but you see someone who is just employing a whole range of other senses in order to connect with you, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I didn't know anyone, really. I've only met people recently in, I've met people in passing, but no, I didn't really have anyone except my wife's granddad, who, quite a strong impression he left on me.
Yeah. Can you outline the research that you did for this, for the Charles-Bonnet?
Well, I mean, I talked a lot to Nina. I talked to who has CBS. And works for is with Esme's umbrella. I talked to Judith Potts. Mm-hmm. I watched as many YouTube with Dominic Fitch as I could find. And I mean, you know, it's all pretty much, I mean, the story was in the pipeline before the lockdown, before any of this, really. But all the actual filming of it and research has been done. So, I mean, I, you know, it's all had to be done on kind of Zooms and YouTube and so on and so on. So, you know, the first element for him is the sight loss and the worry about the it's a relapse of MS. You don't really know. I mean, because it's not a story that just has a simple beginning. It's come from a whole pile of, it's a soap, you know. So I'll try to remember. Well, yeah, I mean, it's because it's a soap, you know, the MS relapsing story and ultimately the Charles-Bonnet story don't just start from nowhere. I mean, the guy already had a whole pile of trouble. He was having trouble in his relationship. He was going to court. He'd been finally confessed over a 30-year crime, struggling with his conscience, struggling with everybody who says you shouldn't do this, and he's saying, I feel I've got to do this. Still struggling with the loss of his son, who had died, took his own life 2 years ago. So there's a whole pile of stuff that led up to this, stress is, you know, he's involved in an armed robbery, and, you know, it's so. So there's a whole pile of stresses and strains that led up to this.
How important do you feel it is to raise awareness of a disability or an illness within soap land, as to speak? Because obviously the audience is massive in any soap. How do you feel it's important?
Well, the simple answer, I think it's incredibly important. It's an incredible privilege, and it's one of the joys of being on Coronation Street. I mean, Coronation Street has always been a campaigning and aware, you know, I mean, modern soaps have a lot of commercial demands on them, but they're still folk tales of people, you know, everyday people's struggles and, you know, endurances, and, you know, I mean, they're folk tales, really. Mm. And they evolve, you know, as the world evolves. But they've always had this campaigning and kind of gateway opening up into, you know, like, let's talk about this in society right from the beginning. And it's a very honourable part of the show. And it's, for me, it's one of the sort of the most exciting elements of the show. I'm not particularly ease with celebrity culture. I mean, I'm an actor. Once you're involved in soap, you kind of get, you get seen in a slightly different way. And, you know, apart from the fact that I just think it, you know, you were fulfilling an obligation and a responsibility that the program has to educate people and to create awareness, it's also just a fantastic balance, you know, kind of redressing the balance for me to the sort of slightly nonsense. It makes sense of being a celebrity. I can bring some sparkle dust to what people are, you know, working very hard to deal with. And you can bring a little bit of sort of magic sparkle dust from Coronation Street. And maybe that's all, but it does quite a lot. You know, I mean, this is one of the most exciting things I've done. I mean, I've worked with the MS Society before and the Alzheimer's Society and the Samaritans, but they're big charities. Yes. And suddenly, you know, the opportunity to work with Esme's Umbrella, who are quite small, they're the only people in the world trying to create awareness of this condition. It's such an easy, you know, I mean, I know that there's no cure at the moment for the CBS element, but simply knowing that you've got it, simply having access to the education and then some coping mechanisms is kind of all it's about at the moment. And if you've got that bit of equipment, if you know what's going on to you, you're going to suffer less. So it's such a simple thing to do. And I found myself in a position where I could do it. And I mean, I'm absolutely, yeah, I mean, it's gives me great joy to be able to do it.
Lovely. It's great. It's really great. And I think you know, I watched the episode, we both watched the episode where you were diagnosed with CBS, and you know, you played it really, you know, you kind of played it down, didn't you? You know what I mean? You played it really calmly, well, almost. Like, you could tell you were in shock.
I mean, yeah, I think, yes, it's wonderful. He finds out that it's that and it's okay. But you see, Johnny, at that point, you haven't quite seen these apps yet. You will probably by the time the podcast goes out. But he wants to continue. He doesn't want to take his meds. He wants to carry on having these hallucinations. Because, and that's why at the end you see some uncertainty in it. It's not just, I'm not just kind of going, oh, my God, now I understand it. It's kind of because he's very conflicted. Because this actually was a real sticking point, and I think it's where the drama was really created between Esme's Umbrella and Coronation Street, because Coronation Street came to them with an idea that they wanted to explore Charles Bonnet syndrome, and they wanted him to see his dead son and have a kind of storyline of, you know, I guess closure and, you know, closure and being at peace with that. He found his son 2 years ago who took taking his own life. So, and it's never been resolved, you know, and I think in a way they wanted to revisit that and to bring that story in. But the science says that you don't really see your loved ones. You know, it's not like that. They were very firm that they don't want it to be seen as being ghosts and things like that.
Yeah.
So yeah. His story is really that he's got a huge yearning to see his son, and he wants to say goodbye, but he never really sees his face. So that's kind of the sort of little twist in the whole tale, really. And part of the reason I felt comfortable doing that is because, you know, I do understand that there are some horrific hallucinations, but they're not all horrific. And there are some, you know, people are, once you know what it is, Johnny decides not to take his meds because he's in prison, and the possibility for him that he might see his son is the only thing that's keeping him going. It's a bit strange and desperate, and ultimately, of course, those people around him, you know, persuade him to take the meds. It's a kind of a mad thing to do, but that's where he is, and that's what he did. So that's the sort of twist on the story. So they've been really honest. They're not saying that this is what you see, but we are looking at a human being who's taking some comfort from it. I know, you know, Nina, for instance, you know, who's helped me a lot with the show, was a visual artist, and she takes great solace from seeing colour. She has no eyesight left, really, but she sees colour. And, you know, I have heard stories of other people who see bodies, you know, see beings, and they'd like to imagine. Maybe they do, but, you know, so that was a point of conflict, I guess, in the creation of the story.
Yeah.
I feel it was they found a really good solution to it, to be honest.
Mm. Yeah, no, we'll look forward to seeing future episodes and seeing how it pans out. It's going to be good.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's finally being highlighted and put into the public arena as well.
Well, that's what's so exciting. I mean, it's kind of been shockingly ignored, you know. And
yeah.
It's quite, and, you know, so this kind of burst of activity that's coming around it. And, you know, it's incredibly exciting to know that around the world, Corrie's watched, and people, a few more million people will have heard of it because of this.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just getting into the mainstream a bit more. And look, that's an amazing, you know, it's other people do the donkey work, and I get loads of credit, but it's fantastic. That's the way I like it, actually.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much, Richard, for giving us your time.
It's been a delight. Thank you for all your support in it as well, and good luck with everything you do. It's wonderful.
Thank you. No, appreciate it much.
I think, you know, just to say something else, I mean, the this morning, the reason that it got that, you know, an ITV soap got on BBC News, which is not something that would normally happen.
No,
you know, because we're sort of competitors, really. Mm-hmm. Was because there's this research come from the RIB that during this lockdown, you know, the quantity and the quality of hallucinations the quantity's gone up and the quality has got more frightening for many people.
Yeah. Yes.
And, you know, I mean, it's absolutely not a mental health problem, but you can see how a context of, you know, anxiety and worry and stress feeds into us. And I could see this, you know, I knew this from my dad when he had Alzheimer's, and it was a long time ago, it was 30 years ago, he had it very strongly for about 10 years. But my mum and my sister were able to look after him, and they were lucky, there was some good volunteers around there, and they got a bit of respite, the Alzheimer's Society helped, and so on and so on. They were quite, and I think they did as well as they could to keep him in an environment where he was disappearing, but I think he felt as secure as he possibly could. And, you know, this idea of your environment being important, I mean, it's kind of obvious, isn't it? And I think it's really interesting that it's almost measurable with the hallucinations. They change according to the context that you're in. So let's just, you know, it's about working as you are, as you know, to create a world where we feel, you know, as secure and as supported and loved as possible.
Yeah.
Definitely agree with you there. Absolutely. Mm.
Well, thank you so much, Richard. That was just amazing. You. Hi everyone, it's Jo and I have with me Dawn.
Hello.
And it's a pleasure to welcome to VI Talk for the first time Judith Potts from Esme's Umbrella. Hiya Judith.
Hello, thank you so much for inviting me.
You're welcome, it's lovely to speak to you. So first of all, Esme's Umbrella is the support and information service, I suppose you would say, for Charles Bonnet syndrome. So do you want to tell us a little bit about Esme's Umbrella first?
Absolutely. Well, Esme's Umbrella is named after my late mum because she was in her early 90s and she had glaucoma, but she lived a very independent life. Her sight was obviously much worse than we had realised. Or that she was prepared to tell us, and I think she was probably compensating a bit as well. And I did notice that her confidence was going. She was an incredibly independent woman. But one day she said to me, I do wish those people would get off my sofa. And of course, there was no one on her sofa. And before I could say anything, she said, and also there's a child that follows me everywhere, and a gargoyle-like creature that jumps from table to chair, and sometimes the whole place morphs into a totally different place. Well, as you can imagine, I was totally shocked, and I thought, well, what on earth can be wrong? But then I thought, well, it's surely she hasn't got dementia. I mean, she was very good at doing the Telegraph cryptic crossword every day and managing on her own, and I had no idea what could be wrong with her. Well, obviously, I told her there was nothing there, and that she shouldn't worry about it. But she did say this had been going on for quite some months, but she obviously didn't tell me because she thought, as I did, the word dementia would be brought into it. Mm. So I went home and I thought, what am I going to do? And with the most enormous piece of luck, that very day, buried in the health pages of a newspaper, I found a tiny paragraph about a condition which was caused by loss of sight, and it could have been written by Esme. And I thought, brilliant, now I know Charles Bonnet syndrome. Okay, I will ring her ophthalmologist, which I did. Unfortunately, and very shockingly, he refused point blank to discuss Charles Bonnet syndrome. He wouldn't tell me why he'd never given us any warning. And in fact, he was so hostile that on her next appointment, he sent his junior with strict instructions not to discuss the condition.
Wow.
So I then went to her GP. She'd never heard of it and said, no, I don't think that exists. Then I went to her optometrist, who also said, I've never heard of anything like this. So I did what we're always told never to do. I consulted the internet, on which I found Dr. Dominic Fitch at King's London. And at the time, I was writing a health column for the Telegraph. So I called him and said, can I come and interview you because I want to write about this condition? And I did. And I told him about Esme, and he confirmed that this is what she had. He explained it to me, and I began to write. And every time I wrote about CBS, my inbox was full of emails from people who were either relieved to discover that it wasn't a mental health issue or who wanted to know more information and who wanted a doctor and medication. And of course, there's neither. So after my mum died, I realized that I absolutely should do something about this and try and raise some awareness. But you know what it's like, you don't. And then I got an email from a professor at a university in New York, and she told me that her mother, much against the will of the family, but on the advice of the doctor, had been admitted to a dementia unit because she was hallucinating. While she was in the unit, she simply could not get past what she perceived to be writhing worms and slugs on her food and in her drink. And so she stopped eating and drinking and died.
Oh, bless her. Oh.
Now, that was the final straw for me. And I thought, we can't have this. We just cannot have this. This is awful. And mm-hmm. the professor said to me she would never forgive herself. So in, 2015, at the House of Commons, I launched Esme's Umbrella using my mum's name. And since then, I have worked really hard to raise awareness of the condition and to source funding for research. And so that's how it all started.
And it is just you, isn't it? It's just you and yourself.
Yes, it's just me.
Wow. Shocking. Absolutely shocking.
It's really hard to believe that it's only 2015 that that people actually started to sit up and take notice, isn't it? That people were struggling so much.
Yes. I mean, Dr. Dominic Fitch had started some research in the late 1990s. And this was in visual hallucinations, in Parkinson's, in Lewy body dementia, and in Charles-Bonnet syndrome. And so he was steadily working, but obviously no one was raising his profile or raising awareness. And I think I was just so shocked, and I still am shocked, that people are living with this condition with no support. And I don't mean you're not supporting them. I mean, there is no kind of, there's no doctor out there. And we are relying on ECLOs and ROVIs to offer some form of support, but we don't really have a proper form of support.
No.
So we've spoken about Esme's Umbrella. And for those, I know a lot of people do know what Charles-Bonnet syndrome is, but for anybody who doesn't or is confused by what we're talking about, do you want to just explain what it is exactly? Mm. And, you know, to, as far as we know, what sort of causes it?
Absolutely. Okay, well, Charles-Bonnet syndrome occurs in a person of any age, and children are not exempt. It happens when the person has lost over 60% of sight. Now, this loss can have been caused by any one of the many, many, many eye diseases, by cancer, accident, stroke, diabetes, or another condition which damages the optic nerve. It causes vivid, silent visual hallucinations, which range from disturbing to terrifying. Mm. It's very important to know that it is not a mental health issue. It is caused entirely by lack of sight. So as sight diminishes or is completely lost, the messages from the retina in the eye to the visual cortex in the brain, which go all the time to and fro, they are reduced in number or they stop entirely. But for some reason we don't yet understand, the brain does not stop. The brain fires up and creates its own images. Now, what is seen depends on which part of the brain is firing at that moment. So if it's the part that interprets color or pattern, then that's what you see. If it's animals or people, then that's what you see. And people report all kinds of images, from very basic ones, as I say, like color, patterns, words, musical notes, maps. And they tend to be incredibly irritating because they cover everything in the room. So even if you have a little bit of sight left and you can watch television or read a book, you can't, because these patterns are everywhere. Other people see animals, they see people. Now, people tend to be dressed, for some reason we have no idea why, in costume of some kind. So military, medieval, that sort of thing. Sometimes the people are tiny. They're like little Lilliputian-sized people. They often come in families. Otherwise, people see fire, which is very frightening, water, which is equally frightening, pouring down from the ceiling. Calls are made quite often to the fire brigade, to the police, which is very disturbing for all concerned because, of course, they arrive and there's nothing there. Sometimes, and this can be really terrifying, the room or the garden will morph into a totally alien place. So one lady told me she found herself sitting in a candlelit medieval cathedral and she was the only person there.
Gosh, oh, bless her.
Now, there is a bit of medication, but the problem with it is that it has terrible side effects. It's the medication that it can be used for dementia and can be used for epilepsy, but it's not recommended and it could never be used for children and it can't be used for the very old. So that really doesn't work. Yeah. I have coping strategies on my website, which I have collected from people who sent them to me, telling me what they do to try and disperse the hallucinations. And just recently, and I have no idea if it's anything to do with COVID-19, but people tell me by eating ginger, so ginger biscuits or crystallized ginger, or even drinking ginger ale is helping. Now, ginger has medicinal properties, so who knows? It's worth a try. Anything is worth a try.
Definitely. That's fascinating. So if we move on to COVID-19, which obviously people are in lockdown and very stressed and anxious, how is that affecting people with CBS?
Well, as we know so little about CBS, but we do know two things. We know, one, that there are at least 1 million people in the UK who live with CBS, and two, that isolation, stress, and fever, so having a temperature, will exacerbate the hallucinations. The other thing which I think is worth mentioning before I forget is that some medication will produce hallucinations, and it is worth checking the side effects of, and I mean medication for another condition, for maybe diabetes or whatever it might be. It's worth having the GP check, because occasionally medication taken for something completely different does make the hallucinations worse.
Yeah.
Indeed, I believe there are some eye drops, the name of which escapes me at this moment, as well, which can cause hallucinations. So because so many people are in isolation with fear, because we all, every single one of us at this moment, is very anxious. We don't know what's going to happen to us. We don't know when we're going to be back to any form of normal. And I think the anxiety in itself is definitely producing more, probably more frightening images too. I have heard from people who tell me that their once benign images are now turning to something much more sinister. And the only thing I can suggest is trying relaxation exercises, which, if I can ever talk to the chap that looks after my website again, he seems to have disappeared. I am going to put some relaxation exercises onto the website, because although we also know that CBS can occur when you are in a very quiet situation. So if you're the passenger in a car, and so you're not having to concentrate, you will very often start to hallucinate and you'll see buildings coming rushing at you and huge giant tractors and that sort of thing. But I think in this particular instance, we probably need some relaxation exercises for people who are finding CBS really, really difficult to tolerate.
That's a really good idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Meditation and relaxation. Yeah.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about your website and what people can find information from there?
My website carries information and explanation, really, of Charles-Bonnet syndrome. It carries details about Dr. Dominic Fitch and myself. It carries the coping strategies that I discussed, which are really, you have to kind of try and shunt your brain into another gear to switch off the cells that are firing. So clapping your hands, clicking your fingers, standing up if you're sitting down, that kind of thing, maybe putting some music on or turning some music off, anything that just moves you around a bit, even if it's not physical, even if it's just in your mind. So it carries all of that. And I will be, at some point this year, if I can find some funding, I'm going to relaunch the website. November is 5 years since I started this work, so I think that might be a good time, and I'm rather hoping that we will be back to a reasonable amount of normality by then. Mm-hmm. And I will be doing an event somewhere to mark the occasion. And I think there'll be a lot more on the website then, and it will be much more interactive. My problem is that I have no funding, so I have to rely on very kind people to do these things for me.
So you have a helpline as well, don't you? Which is now, you did run that yourself, but obviously just being you, that's become very busy, hasn't it?
It has become very busy, and the iHealth team at the RNIB have taken it over for me, and they are brilliant. They will send any information plus the coping strategies, which they have for me, through the post if people call. Now, the number is different to the regular RNIB number. It is 0207 391 3299.
Right, for anybody listening, we'll put that information in the description with the interview so that people don't have to remember it. So
that would be absolutely lovely. And I would just say also that if the caller wants to speak to me particularly, the RNIB call me and tell me, and I then ring the person back. I'm very happy to do that. Absolutely. If they would like to talk to someone who lives with Charles-Bonnet syndrome, there are a couple of people on the Retina UK's helpline to whom we can refer to them. So that is good. The other thing is that the Macular Society offers a group telephone counselling service for people who live with Charles-Bonnet syndrome. Now, for this particular service from the Macular Society, you don't have to have a macular condition. Anybody with Charles-Bonnet syndrome can ring. And what you do is you ring 0300 30 30 111 and just ask to join.
Right.
Now, I know group telephone counselling isn't for everybody, but I do know that Suzanne, who runs it, has had huge success with this. And I would recommend, if people feel that's for them, go for it.
And sometimes just talking to somebody who's experiencing it can make you just feel like you're not alone, can't it? Just, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
What advice would you give somebody who's living on their own? Obviously, services have been cut, such as rehabs and ECLOs. What advice would you give somebody who's living on their own at the moment experiencing it?
Well, I think I would ring my helpline at the RNIB.
Yeah.
They will talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll pass them on to me if they want to talk to me. I think I would try the Macular Society's telephone counselling, group telephone counselling service too. I don't know what else. I wish there were 100 things I could suggest, but there aren't. I mean, one of the things we will be doing in the future is to set up some research projects to find out what we can do in the way of support. What people would like us to do and how we can do it, because it's such a very specialized area that I don't want to just, you know, guess without actually consulting people.
Yes.
I did discover that I was a stakeholder in the new Moorfields Hospital, which is planned in London. And they called me and asked me whether I felt that people with Charles-Bonnet syndrome were being treated unfairly. And I said, yes, I do think that. They are not only being treated unfairly, they're being discriminated against because there are no specialist nurses. And there's no hospital hub just for Charles-Bonnet syndrome. So they have promised me faithfully that once the hospital is built, this will be remedied. I know that Moorfields and also the Manchester Eye Hospital are looking at finding funding for specialist nurses, but I fear this is way down their list now.
Such a shame.
It is a great, great shame. I'm hoping that the research which we have put in place will come to fruition at some point. We are expecting, we have done 2 years of a research project at Newcastle University. A lovely lady called Kat De Silva Morgan has been basically, you can tell I'm not a doctor, comparing the brains of people with CBS against those with sight loss who don't develop it. And if we can establish the difference, that will be very, very helpful. Now, yeah. I don't know whether how far they've got. I don't know whether they have established a difference, but we will, I hope perhaps May or June time, the result of that will come out. They've also been testing, I think it's called deep cranial stimulation, which is a way of switching the cells off. And if that works, that will be good too. From now, we have, I have sourced funding partly from actually from Esme's umbrella. I have a restricted fund under the auspices of Fight for Sight, and people are very kind and put money into this fund, which can only be used for research into CBS. And blind veterans have matched the amount I have found. So we have a researcher starting soon. I can't announce exactly who yet. There is also another piece of research which has been funded by Fight for Sight and the Welsh Government. And that will be done at Cardiff University. So that's very good. I sourced from the Thomas Pocklington Trust £15,000 for a research project to establish prevalence of CBS in children. So all the pediatric ophthalmology clinics will be surveyed. And I think something else will be added on to that as well. So we'll hear from patients too. And the last piece, which I think is really exciting, but I think we'll have to wait a bit now, is the medical detection dogs. Now, these dogs you probably know about at the moment because they are going to be sniffing COVID-19.
Yeah, right.
Well, there is a lovely young man called Dr. Amit Patel, who was a trauma doctor at University College Hospital in London until he had a hemorrhage behind his eyes and lost his sight overnight. Mm-hmm. His guide dog, Kika, has begun to warn him before his hallucinations appear.
Oh, that's interesting.
There is also another chap that we have discovered whose guide dog is doing the same. Now, Amit's hallucination, the one in particular, is really horrible. It's of a girl dressed in white with mud and blood pouring from her face. Mm-hmm. He sees this 4 or 5 times a day, and he has never managed to come to terms with it. And he's a young man. He has 2 small children. It's not age that's causing him not to be able to come to terms with it. It is just horrific. But Kika, the dog, now goes and puts her head on his lap before it happens.
Wow.
She seems to know when it's gone and she moves away. So I used to write a lot about these sniffing dogs because they sniffed a lot of cancer.
Yeah.
And so I called Dr. Claire Guest, who runs the charity, and I told her about Kika, and I said, do you think this is possible? And she said, entirely possible. Something changes in the body before a hallucination appears. And if the dogs can identify what it is, and we can feed that into some other research, who knows what we might find.
Mm.
So there were, of course, they were immediately going to do this for me, and they were going to cover the cost. But I think that probably will have to wait a bit now.
Yeah, that's exciting, though.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
It's brilliant, and I just love the thought of it.
Yeah, very comforting as well, isn't it? You know, if you're going through something traumatic, having your assistance dog, you know, we're both guide dog owners, so the thought of that is really lovely.
Yes.
Watch this space, as I say.
Yes,
yeah, definitely. Keep us posted. That'd be great.
Judith, do you want to give us your web address?
I do. Okay. It is www.charles, which is Charles, Bonnet, which is Bonnet, syndrome.uk. There's no co, it's just .uk. So it's www.charlesbonnetsyndrome.uk. I mean, the thing is that Charles Bonnet was Swiss, Genevan, and so I always pronounce it as he would have done.
Yeah.
He actually, March of this year was 300 years since his birth. So you can imagine he documented what happened to his grandfather, and he realized it was to do with the sight. But nobody until the 1990s did anything else about it.
Mm-hmm. That's very scary.
It is scary. It is scary. So we all have to gather together now and nag, but we can't really nag the NHS at this precise moment. So we're going to have to wait a bit to nag.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you've definitely got two supporters here.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very grateful.
Thank you ever so much for talking to us, Judith. It's been really fascinating, and it's great to hear what research is in the pipeline, if, you know, not being done now, but, you know, that will happen in the future.